Welcome to Journeys of Romance. I'm your host, Jess Michaels. My next guest writes contemporary romance for Kensington Publishing. She's been a multiple Golden Heart and Rita finalist, and her December book was recently named a Best Book of 2018 by Publishers Weekly. Welcome the wonderful Priscilla Olivares.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much for coming. I appreciate it. You still there?
Yes. Hi.
Okay,
sorry.
Sorry. That's good.
something clicked and I thought, oh my gosh, I already did something.
No, you know, it's always the technical, like, it's hilarious how many times I start this out, like, well, thank you so much for putting up with our technical difficulties. But yeah, sometimes you'll pick up sound from the other mic, so
okay,
it's totally fine.
Yes. No, I'm still here. I'm over on the East Coast, so it's nice to be chatting with you across the miles.
Yes, we're far apart because I'm in Arizona and I'm still on Pacific time until Sunday. When we're recording this, it'll be Sunday that we switched back to daylight savings.
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
And Arizona doesn't switch, so we will move into mountain time then while everybody else goes an hour back. It's the weirdest thing. I don't know. It the only time it ever really screws me up is when I have meetings. Like I used to have a standing meeting with my literary agent when I still had a literary agent. And so it would move from 12 o'clock to 11 o'clock because time changed.
Yeah.
Like I changed, but she didn't change. So, or I guess I didn't change, but she changed.
She did, yes.
So
yes.
That's the only time it ever screws me up. But, you know, we were talking about this earlier. It's like with writer brain, like my brain doesn't really like I don't want to know. I have enough stuff in there, like for books.
Right.
I don't need technical information as well.
That's so funny because I'm the same way. I feel like when I might hear information, but if I don't need to know, it's similar to like when my girls were still at home and if they were like, they were all in show choir and they were in theater. And so if one group was told, okay, you need to arrive at 10, but the group that my child was with, we were told a different time, I would remember that time.
And you remember 10.
And so like, it was kind of like, I have room in my brain for the information that I need to know. And sometimes I can't even remember what I'm supposed to need to know. So if I hear something that I don't need to know, odds are it's not going to stick. You know,
so don't give me any extra information.
Yes.
Well, that's gotta be hard to, you know, I mean, I think maybe that's a kind of a writer mind thing because we are creatives. And so we don't, like some information just doesn't get through because you have creative stuff in your head.
Yes.
But I think it's harder because, you know, I mean, you have all this technical stuff that you have to know now. I mean, you and I were talking about setting up a Facebook ad earlier before we started recording, and it's like all this extra stuff is now expected, or you think you should do it. You have to give it a try to see if it helps with your career. Mm-hmm. And it just requires a whole extra layer of stuff.
Right. And I feel like we are, at least in our society, we're bombarded with information. And so there are times where you could have information overload or I'm, you know, for me, I could be in a situation where it's flipped. Like I can remember the most mundane, you know, random thing that I did here, but the one thing that I'm trying to call to mind, I'm like, bummer, I know it's in there.
Well, for me, it's like, I can remember song lyrics, you know, a song will come on from, you know, 1992 and I'm like, I know every lyric. How come I don't have more, like I could have cured cancer if I didn't have this in my brain. Like,
oh,
come on.
That must be like a universal thing. I will tell you, my mom and I, a few years ago for Valentine's Day, I got her Barry Manilow was going to be in the area. And I had never seen him, but I remember as a kid listening and, you know, and so I treated my mom. She and I went, and no kidding, like two notes into the song, and
you would know exactly.
And I'm singing along with all of these words. But the day before, I had been at the grocery store, and I went in needing five things, and I could not remember like what that fifth thing was. And I'm like, how can this happen? So yeah.
But meantime, you know, you probably have 15 different stories brewing in your mind,
going
right
on
now.
In your head. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes. That you can't get to because you got to finish what you're working on right now. The universal truths of authors, everyone.
Yes, I agree.
So your bio says that you won an award in second grade for reading the most over the summer.
Yes.
So safe to say you've always been a reader.
Yes. A lot of people ask me what brought me into writing, and I'd probably say just my love of the written word, just from love of reading, you know, kind of just grew from there.
Was there like a specific, I know a lot of people on the podcast have mentioned, you know, Sweet Valley High or Babysitter's yeah. Club or like those kinds of, was there like a specific series that you were super into or?
I would say like, and it's funny, someone asked me this earlier this week and yes, like I remember reading Babysitter's Club and all of those earlier sneaking, Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, you
oh
know,
my
the
God,
Judy
I love
Blume,
that one.
All of those. But I think when I take a step back and I try to think about books that there was like a feel to them that I can recall, that I can remember, that drew me as a reader, it's probably like those Victoria Holt, those gothic novels.
Oh, yeah.
And I, at least those are the ones that stick in my brain as when I was younger, books that were able to evoke some kind of emotion or some kind of sense because of the words on the page. So while I devoured the other kind of series that we've talked about, when I think back, I would say those Victoria Holt gothic novels were the ones that, as a writer, I would see how the written word can evoke different feelings within a reader.
Well, and Victoria Holt, too. I mean, I had actually really forgotten about Victoria Holt till you brought it up. I'm like, oh, Victoria Holt. So, oh my God, like these conversations always leave me with like, I need to reread
yes,
some, whatever,
yeah.
X from when I was a kid. I probably wouldn't like it as much, though, that sometimes, you know, like something you loved as a kid, you just don't love. But
yes.
Victoria Holt was kind of romance adjacent. Like there would be mm-hmm. kind of a little bit of a romance-y sort of element to it. And the same thing with a lot of those other series as kids, you know, there mm-hmm. was a little bit of a romance element. Do you think that made you more open to romance when you first were exposed to it? Which is a really good story, by the way, how you kind of became a romance reader.
my foray into, my ushering into adult romance
right.
is a little different. Yeah. I think so. I would say probably the first short stories that I wrote in high school was an English teacher that first said to me, planted kind of that little seed of, have I thought about writing, or doing something, going into writing. And then, that kind of led to then me going on to, majoring in English. But I think so, yeah, I kind of had that propensity of liking that romance feel. And so that's probably what led to, plus the romance reading was modeled. My mom read, but my dad was a voracious reader of almost anything, but in particular of romance. So
really?
I think it was, I modeled, yes, whether it was the Harlequin Presents, any of those category lines, or a bigger book, you would see like a Larry McMurtry book along with a romance novel, you know, on his nightstand or somewhere in the house. And so I kind of, there were just books around all the time. And
yeah.
So it kind of led to that.
Well, and you know, I mean, you're talking about the Victoria Holt's kind of evoking an emotion. And I mean, mm-hmm. that's really what hopefully we do when we write romance. You know, I mean, that's the emotion is the core of the story. So, I mean, it makes sense. I actually think it's kind of silly that more men don't read romance because they want emotion too, right?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes.
But they get kind of put off by the genre, I guess.
I think there's, it's, gosh, this is kind of like a whole can of worms, but let's open that.
Let's
bag.
Open it.
I think it's that stigma, unfortunately, mm-hmm. whether, I mean, it's in the books, it's in movies, it's in TV shows that, you know, we're kind of, we've been battling against and hopefully chipping away at little by little that you know, a rom-com or even, a straight romance that, you know, with the drama, there's nothing to, no reason to shy away from it. There's no reason to second rate it.
Yes.
You know, like you said, the emotional, I liked that how you brought up that the emotions are what really plays into our books. I teach an online, a continuing education course, and we talk about how, when we talk about GMC, I say that why, that motivation part, the goal, motivation, and conflict, that motivation part is key in romance
yeah.
because it helps the reader identify and understand why a character is doing or saying or not doing or not saying something. And within romance, that emotion you know, is what you're trying to evoke in your readers for your characters. And so, yeah, I think it across the board, you know, male, female, you know, however you identify, romance should be part of your reading pleasure.
Yeah, I agree. Well, and it's really cool that your dad kind of had that ability to sort of transcend what would be seen as, you know, oh, this is a woman's book, you know, versus, you know, that right. he even back then could kind of. And he gave you your first romance, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. the story.
Yes. Yes. We were, my dad was in the military and we were stationed in Key West, and then he wound up retiring. We stayed there. So junior high and high school, I was in Key West, home of the Fighting Conks, Key West High School, and, hurricane, you know, season, June through November every year. So one year when I was in high school, I want to say my sophomore year, but when I was in high school, we had to evacuate, leave our home and go to a hurricane shelter. We didn't evacuate the Keys, but we were in a shelter on base and for several days. And probably like by day two, I had already used or done or, you know, whatever entertainment things I had, because this was obviously before the days of cell phone service. And so by day two, I was kind of bored out of my mind and I was driving my parents out of their mind. And my dad, as part of his hurricane goodies, or I can't think, the word just flipped out of my head, but the part of his hurricane supplies that he took, one of them was a bag full of Harlequin romance novels. And so he was like, look, quit bugging us, just get one of my books and read, you know, just for to entertain yourself. And that was the first time that I picked up an adult romance and was ushered into the amazing world of romance novels as
and
a reader.
Off to the races.
Yes, and never looked back.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because that's the truth. Like, once you start,
yes.
you're done. Like, you're hooked.
So.
So, you started writing. I mean, obviously, it sounds like you were writing. I think most of us that are writers were writing. But you sort of, it sounds like you sort of seriously started writing when you went into college. Is that?
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
What sort of drove that decision to move from kind of a straight reader to someone that was kind of more interested in writing?
Really, it was the need to have, I was a young college co-ed, a young wife and with a newborn, and my then husband was military. And so I had to, because of a quick military move, I had to take a semester off of college and wait to start the next semester at a new institution. Mm-hmm. And that fall semester, I was home with a newborn, a little baby, and really just needing to be keeping my mind active and doing something. I just, like a lot of people, kind of foolishly, I would say myself, but foolishly thinking, well, I like to read them. Let me just try writing one. How hard could it be?
But it's the common thread, you know.
Yes.
Oh, this will be easy. And
yes.
Then 4 minutes in, like, nope, it's
yes.
not. It's not easy.
You don't know what you don't know. And I did not know a lot. But really it was just, you know, I had gone from homework and baby feeding, you know, home, you know, college student and mommying at the same time to just mommying. And I wanted to have, I needed to be keeping my mind active. So I started me and my handy dandy electric typewriter typing away at a book called Moonlit Beaches. And that's all the world will ever know about it, because it was not a good book.
But you learn from those books, you know, those
definitely.
Under the bed books. I mean, you
yes.
definitely, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, I probably have 10 of them that are under the bed. So
yes.
it's
yes.
fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, because I don't think there's a wasted word. You know, you don't write a wasted word, because you either learn from it or it, you know, it goes somewhere more.
Yeah. Oh, totally. I think all of the books before I finally sold, I feel I improved. I grew craft-wise. I grew also, you know, I matured as a writer. I matured as a person.
Yeah.
It took me a long time from that first, you know, it was a dark and stormy night. No, that's not how it started, but from that first word on that electric typewriter to when my first book came out last October was 27 years.
Yeah.
So it was a long time. But a lot of living in between. I tell myself all that living will hopefully feed into my books now.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, because looking, you know, kind of reading you know, it was a long haul for you, and you stuck in, and that's hard. Cause I mean, I did it not for that long, but I mean, you know, I know that feeling of kind of like, what am I doing here? Mm-hmm. Like, what am I doing with my life here?
Yeah.
So, did you find RWA? Like what kind of kept you going at the beginning?
Well, after I wrote that first book, before I knew about RWA, like literally I finished that manuscript. I put a sticky note on it with my name and my address and I put a rubber band around it and I stuck it in the mailing. And I opened up one of my Harlequin romances and I found the address and I just mailed it off like that. totally everything that you're not supposed to do other than mailing it. And even now today, you don't do that anymore.
Well, you put a rubber band around Priscilla. It's fine.
Yes. It was all together with that nice rubber band. It was shortly, like probably a year or two after that, a family member while they were traveling, they found a how-to romance writing book and they bought it and gave it to me. And one of the resources listed in that book was Romance Writers of America. So
and then you kind of found.
Yes. So that's how through, you know, so it was probably just a couple years into me trying to figure out how to become a romance writer that I, by then I had like moved overseas. And so I joined RWA from overseas. And really that was like 1993, I believe. And I never I maintained my membership with RWA over those years, even when I have to be honest, I say 27 years, but I was not chained to a desk writing for those 27 years.
Sure.
I finished my undergrad and got two graduate degrees and, I have three daughters and we homeschooled when they were in elementary school. And so I did a lot of other stuff that I made that personal decision that writing wasn't my number one priority. So for me, I say, it's not to say that when you're raising kids, you can't write because there are plenty, successful authors that do. But for me, I wrote in between a lot of doing other things. But that was always, I think part, when I look back, I think part of why I never let my RWA membership lapse, even in the years where, you know, I was just writing a little bit, it was mostly because there's a part of me that felt if I cut that tie, I did have that fear that dream or that goal kind of would slip away. And as long as I still had a meeting that when there wasn't a show choir competition, I could go to a meeting that, you know, that month or something like that. I could still keep learning when I had the time or when I was able to make the time to keep learning about the craft and learning about the industry, because between RWA and then flash forward into the, you know, mid, you know, 2010 is when I started my MFA. So between RWA and the writing popular fiction program at Seton Hill University, the majority of my writing friends and mentors and, you know, teachers are the knowledge that I know about the craft and about our industry has predominantly been because of those two entities. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it took me a long time to maybe get published, but I feel I really appreciate the blessings that I have now. And when I'm feeling stressed, I tell myself, look, girl, you've been praying for a long time for this kind of stress, so you better enjoy it.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, and also I think that there's something to be said for, I mean, overnight success is lovely. And, mm-hmm. I'm sure people that have it are happy. Mm-hmm. I mean, as happy as any of us are.
Yeah.
But, I think there is something to be said for going through that slog. And you really know what you're capable of. You're not, I've said this in previous podcasts, when my first book came out, I was working on my third or fourth book for them, I think at the time, or third book probably. And I remember thinking, if I didn't know how to write, I would feel like I didn't know how to write right now. Like I would feel completely lost because the whole system changes. And so, I felt very comfortable because I had written so many books beforehand. So I do think that there's a value in those times of just, you're kind of working through it and you're getting the rejections and you're putting in the time and because you're going to put the time in pre or post, like, at the, the time's still going to pass. So, I mean, I don't think there's any wasted time in writing.
No, I don't at all. I think I've learned from each of the books that came before I feel like I've learned. I've grown as a writer. So they were all good teachable moments along the way.
But I'm sure too. I mean, again, there is struggle though. I mean, you do question yourself, and
oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm sure that there were times when you wanted to quit. I know I did. I would quit, and then 3 days later, I'd be like, I can hear a person talking in my head. I should probably write that down.
and I think even there were times when I didn't quite realize I was doubting myself that it was easier to say, well, I don't have time right now because I'm doing this and this and this, you know, with my family. But I remember getting the call about a contest final, and my oldest was there, and when I hung up, I burst into tears, and she immediately was like, oh my gosh, Mom, what's wrong?
Who's dead?
And yeah, and it, but they weren't tears of excitement or joy. They were tears of relief. And yeah. At that moment, it hit me that, you know, I was really doubting myself and my writing. And as much as I loved it and as much as I wanted it, I think there inside of me, I was uncertain if that would be possible for me. And getting that call kind of triggered me to recognize that I was having those doubts, but it was also a huge relief. It was like a boost, like, see, no,
yeah, shot in the arm.
Someone else is thinking that I'm okay, or at least I'm on the right track with this book. So I gotta keep going. And so there were, yes, by all means, those up and downs. One time I remember getting a rejection or from a publisher, and this was back when they would mail you back the manuscript. Mm-hmm. And I had been spent the afternoon racing around with my girls, and I was supposed to be going to a church retreat. It was a silent retreat, so there was going to be like no talking other than when you were like in the meetings the whole weekend. And I wasn't really looking forward to going. And we pull up in front of our house after running all the errands to get everybody settled, and there's a big package on the front door from the publisher. And so you immediately know. Oh man. And I wanted to just sit down and cry, but I had to get my kids, you know, get everything ready for the house for Mom to be gone for the weekend and pack my bag. And so I didn't even have time to be able to process that I had just gotten a rejection again. And I get all packed and I say goodbye and I get to the retreat center and I'm pulling out my Bible and there's a card in there that my middle daughter had made while I was all in a tizzy of getting everybody ready and me leaving. And it was like a child's design on the cover. And when you open it up, she had said, "Mommy, I don't care that the people in New York didn't want your book. I think you're the bestest writer," or something Aww. Like that. And I was, and yes, okay, then I cried.
Yeah.
And I had that release. But I think it was, looking back, I hope it was a positive role modeling. I'm kind of losing my words here. For my girls, that I held on to that and little by little kept trying to get closer to achieving that goal.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, your daughters must be so proud of you to have stuck in and then really like seeing the success that you're seeing now.
I hope so. actually yesterday, my oldest tweeted, because I had a release day yesterday or I guess by the time this airs, it won't be yesterday. It will be earlier on Tuesday. I had a release day for, I have a novella called Holiday Home Run, and it's in the Fern Michaels anthology, holiday anthology, A Season to Celebrate. And so my oldest, trying to do her little part of helping spread the word, she tweeted out something like, so the woman who always told me not to play Christmas music before Halloween just released a holiday novella. and then she did, but she put hashtag proud daughter. Aww. So that's always nice.
That's so sweet.
Yeah. I think so. I'm really proud of my girls. I think hopefully it's that's reciprocated, you know, or returned.
So you talked earlier about that you got your MFA in from Seton Hill, and mm-hmm. that's the Writing Popular Fiction program, which is kind of, I think it's really the only program in the country that is about writing popular fiction. So, and I've always been curious about that program. Can mm-hmm. you talk a little bit more about what pushed you there and kind of your experience?
Oh, sure. I will say, I don't know the numbers, but I know that there are several others, one or two handfuls. I don't want to give like a number because I don't know, but I know that there are some other options, like Arcadia University also has one that's up in the Pennsylvania area. But mm-hmm. when I started at Seton Hill, it was June of 2010, and there were even fewer. But Seton Hill's program, it's your MFA, Master of Fine Arts in Writing Popular Fiction, so it's genre fiction. There are MFA programs all around the country, all around the world. A lot of them tend to be more literary. Seton's what drew me to them. And honestly, I found out about it because they had an ad in the Romance Writers Report. That's the monthly mm-hmm. magazine that comes from RWA. And I had in my undergrad taken, my degree, my undergrad's English. I had taken a writing workshop, a creative writing workshop for, you know, a 3-credit class. And I did not enjoy it because I learned right away that before even when you arrived, you had submitted a short story or a piece, and it was going to get critiqued by several people, and that's kind of how you kicked off this weekend of this mm-hmm. writer's workshop, and nobody was a fan. It was so obviously I wrote a romantic short story, and it was right away denigrated. It was like, you know, nobody liked it. And that weekend I realized, after going to, you know, all the classes and everything, you had to pick 4 assignments that you were gonna turn in. You had a certain amount of time to turn in for your grade. And I learned, though, that if I wanted to maintain my A average, my GPA, and, you know, and that I would have to write the type of story or in the type of way that the 4 professors that I had selected to do their assignment, what they thought was good writing or what they would like to read. And so obviously I never took another creative writing workshop in my undergrad. So with the MFA, when I first heard about Seton and or Seton Hill, and I called and I spoke with the director, I told myself, look, it's okay to go this first semester. And it sounds like it's an awesome program, and it sounds like they're really welcoming to romance. But if I got there and I discovered that, okay, it was a lot like the other one, and romance, like, is common in academia, is kind of like shunned, then it would be okay to not continue in the program.
Yeah, not keep going.
Right? Because I was not going to spend 2.5 years, almost 3
writing
years.
Writing something that you have no interest in.
Yes.
To make somebody else happy.
Yes. And paying graduate. And
yeah, and paying for the
purpose. Paying for that, yes. Paying for someone to tell me that what I'm writing is not just because it was romance. But I will say what I found was the exact opposite. It's the Seton Hill program to me is more like, just like I say, RWA is part of my romance family. The writing popular fiction community, the faculty, the staff, the alumni, and the current students. I just returned this in June every year during the June residency. There's also an alumni retreat, and you have a big book signing. So I went back to participate in the retreat and then participate in the book signing, because my debut novel was actually, or is, my thesis manuscript that was written during my time at Seton Hill. So I wanted to kind of come full circle and be able to have a signing for that book there, you know, on the campus or as part of that community. It's a low-res program, a low-residency, so we go in January and June at the start of the spring and the fall semesters. You're up in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, just outside of Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. and for kind of like a week, 5 days of intensive classes during the day, workshops or thesis readings in the evening, and then the rest of the semester, it's online classes and working on your manuscript, and frankly, I thought, boy, if I get an MFA, I will you know, have the opportunity to teach now with my MFA, and my homework is either to be reading a romance or to be writing a romance, and I want to be doing that anyway. So yeah. It's like win-win.
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
Yes, I loved it.
Because I've always heard sort of about it, but I don't think mm-hmm. I've ever spoken to anyone who went. I mean, it sounds like it's a really, like, useful...
Yes. I mean, you're paying for a graduate degree.
Sure.
So some people would say, well, yeah, but if I don't want to teach, is the MFA worth it? I would say it's individual. You know, as an individual, you'll have to, you know, weigh your pros and cons. But for me, it was a blessing that I had the opportunity. And frankly, I was in the middle of my first master's degree when I found out about Seton, and I wanted to just apply right away. But I wouldn't let myself stop that first master's program. I'm like, you started it. You need to finish it. And so I did fast track, and I crammed two semesters into one so that I could graduate in May.
Just to get out of there.
Yeah. Well, I would like graduate in May.
Get that degree, go on to the next degree.
Yes. My graduation gift to myself was graduate in May and start Seton in June.
Wow.
So, and my first MFA, I mean, my first master's has been useful, like in day job and career, stuff like that. But the MFA, if I didn't have to pay tuition every semester, I would keep going back to residency because I loved it.
Wow. Yes. Well, that's high praise.
So
that transitions us really well into, your first book with Kensington came out last year, right?
It was an October release.
So you're a year into mm-hmm. writing for them, and yes. It's a traditional publisher. Mm-hmm. So how did that first sale come about? And how much did you cry?
Oh, gosh. I cried. We popped a bottle of bubbly. We
you earned it.
Yes. That came about when I graduated from Seton. I got my current agent, Rebecca Strauss. She's with DeFiore, DeFiore and Company. And so I started working with Rebecca. And we revised my thesis manuscript a couple times. Like, we went through a couple rounds of revisions, she and I together. And then we went on submission. And, gosh, I'd have to think about what that date was. And I don't want to kill time here and be, like, trying to think back in my head. But we went on submission, like, mid-fall of 1 year. And I guess of 2015. And then... I signed, then Kensington offered early 2016. And so, and because it's traditional, that's kind of like the longer process. Like,
yeah,
I signed in March a 3-book contract for my thesis manuscript. It's His Perfect Partner. And Yasmin has two sisters that you meet in book one, Rosa and Lily. And so my contract with Kensington was for Yasmin's story, book one, and then book two and three to tell all three sisters' story. And so book one was written, book two and three were not. They were, I had, some ideas on paper for book two, and then book three was just in my brain.
Right, you need the character, but not necessarily what you're going to do with her.
Yes, and so they did ask for kind of like a couple pages of like what the stories would be like. But I will tell you, like, Lily changed a little bit. Diego was always going to be a cop. I knew Lily would do something with taking care. Honestly, at first I thought she was going to be a vet tech. But then as I talked to her and as things kind of came together, Lily is a victim's advocate. She's book three. Rosa was always a librarian, a poet, her journaling isn't a diary. It's more a private poetry journal. And so Rosa kind of stayed true. She's the second sister. But I didn't have their books written. And I'll tell you, that was the learning curve for me. I had my whole MFA, the whole time of my whole MFA, to be writing book one.
Right.
And then book two.
Now you have a deadline that's much tighter.
Yes. And I'll say one good thing also about the Seton Hill program, you had to learn to write to a deadline, because at the start of every semester, you sign a contract with your mentor, like the professor or the instructor, the author that's going to, that is your mentor you have a mentor for one or two years. For half of the time, and then you switch to a second one. But at the beginning of the semester, you sign a contract of how many new pages you're going to write, or if your book is done and you're revising, how many pages you're going to revise. You also have like a how-to book that you're going to read, and you write a paper about it, what you learned, how it helped, that kind of thing. But so every month I had to submit to my mentor the pages that I had contracted for. At the same time, I had two other critique partners, and we were supposed to exchange work, and I would submit to my mentor the copies of what I had critiqued so that they could know for sure that I was critiquing and I was upholding my end of the bargain that way. So I had a deadline kind of every month. Uh-huh. And so that did help me anyway, but it was still a little bit different from, here was this New York publisher that I had a contract with. And some days it was a little stressful. Some days it was also motivational, but I had a lot less time. So that was kind of, for me, the learning curve going from unpublished to published. Before, it was just all about writing. Now you had to learn you're writing the next book, but oh wait, you got to stop because revisions or copy edits or page proofs are coming in. So you're at two different
parts of the process.
Yeah,
two books,
yeah, and... yeah. And you're at two different parts of the process. Or then it became, you're trying to market a book that's out, but you're getting ready for one that's about to release, but yet you're like writing another one. Yeah, so there's a
publishing industry is not really meant for mindfulness of being in the moment. Like you're always you're either writing a book that won't come out for a year or won't come out for a few months, or yeah. And you're revising a book that you finished 6 months ago, and you have a book out right now that you wrote a year and a half ago. Like there's not really a lot of like in the moment.
Yes. No. Or there are a lot of balls that you're juggling.
Yes.
And I think for me, like advice I would say is find as an individual, because what works for me might not work for you. An advice to a newer author or a newer published author or whatever is find a system that works for you so that you're not going crazy. Are you a planner? Then use a planner. Is it just a calendar on the wall? Is it an app on your phone or some way? Because there are a lot of moving parts, and you want to, help yourself to be as productive as you can.
How do you do it? How do you track all the moving parts?
Well, obviously, since I thought our call today was at 10 and it was supposed to be at 11, I'm not doing very well.
You're fine.
but I use kind of like a combination. I really use, which I didn't trust today, I'll use my calendar and I'll set alarms. Mm-hmm. Depending on what it is. Do I need the alarm the day before? Do I need the alarm 30 minutes? I do have a planner, but I will tell you that's something that I'm trying to get better at. And I am not a planner there are not a bunch of pretty stickers and a bunch of pretty colors. It's my planner.
I wish I was good at that. Like, oh. I look at it and it's so pretty and my handwriting looks like chicken scratch. And I'm just like, my calendar doesn't look like that.
No. And mine is all pencil. I don't even
right,
put pen.
God forbid, things yes. will change.
Yes, yes. But it works for me as far as, and I'm a huge to-do lister. So
yeah, me too.
Between my phone and I actually use the Panda Planner because that works for me. But my phone, the calendar on my phone and notes on my phone. I might have my running to-do list there as well as like in my Panda Planner. And that way, if I don't have my... if I'm
right, you have one or the other if you
yes,
need to look.
Yeah, it kind of.
I also find that the act of writing it down physically helps me for some reason. Mm-hmm. So I have a planner, and then my husband's really pushing me to like use the calendar on my phone, and so I'll have half my stuff in the phone and half not, and then it doesn't help me at all.
Oh no!
So I'm like, I still like to write it down.
Yes. Well, I do. Because I really like technology, but. There are times where there is still, I think, the old timer in me that before, because I lived in the day and I mommied in the days before, I had a laptop and I had a cell phone. So I had, it was the paper planner, that calendar. And so I still have like my planner. I actually have a big calendar on one of my desks because I have that fear like, something's in what the cloud. Right. If something goes wrong with my technology and it's in the cloud, I'm like, yes, but I cannot touch the cloud. I cannot see the cloud. I don't know how to get it off of the cloud, but see, my Panda Planner, it is in my hands and I can flip through the pages and find what I'm looking for. So I do both. I think mostly just because I need that sense of security.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
And I think whatever works is what works. I mean, it's the same thing with, plotting versus pantsing or, making all of the choices that we make. I mean, it always feels suspect to people that are like, you always have to do it this way. It's like, no. Yes. 'Cause there's not really a right way.
No. Even, I think in my class online, I'll say, look, we're talking about all these tips and all these tools. And the thing is here, if this tool, our scene in SQL lesson, that's a harder concept. Some people use it without even knowing that they are. Some people use it knowing they are. Some people are like, what the heck? Yeah. And so I just say, anything that I tell you, if it's stopping your process, if it's making it more difficult, set that aside. Maybe later you might come back to it, or maybe you tweak something that we've talked about, or something that works for me, tweak it so that it enhances your process and it helps you, there's nothing that's gospel.
Yeah.
So.
So one thing I noticed was that your book Resort to Love was part of the Paradise Key series,
yes,
which looks like it's set up by Kensington, and so they have kind of an overarching setting, and then authors write different, they're different authors that write different books in the series. I think yours is the third, right?
Yeah, and actually that is with Thule Publishing.
Oh, okay.
It's not, yeah, sorry.
Is it not McKenzie? Yeah. Sorry.
No, I did. I wrote that book. There were four of us. And
yeah. How does that work? Do you guys have a Bible? How do you set it up working within somebody else's world?
So that book, that series, it's with Shirley Jump. She wrote book one. Kira Jacobs wrote book two. I wrote book three. And then Susan Meyer wrote book four. And actually, the idea was like, I think Shirley and Kira are friends, and they conceived the idea of four best friends reunited because there's a fifth best friend, and she has recently passed away, and so the four of them have come back to this, and so they kind of had that idea. I think they reached out to Susan and they reached out to me, and I didn't know Kira or Susan, and it was the first time I'd ever written a continuity with a group of people. So to be honest, I was super nervous. It worked out beautifully. We had a Google document. We did a lot via email, talking and chatting. Then we created a Google document that had basics. It had our little one pagers about our characters and about our story, and then any kind of description. And so what we wound up doing is Shirley and I live in Florida, and we took a place, it's called Cedar Key on the Gulf Coast, and that was kind of our model and for Paradise Key. So we changed the whole layout of the little town. It's a little beachside town on the Gulf of not in the Panhandle, but on the Gulf of the Maine kind of part of Florida. Yeah. And we just change. So we use the city layout, but change, like, we invent the Java Hut is a coffee shop, and I realized mine want to go get ice cream, so the ice cream shop is here, and
right, so everybody had to know where things were in the town.
Yes,
that's really interesting.
Or this, once we knew about our ideas, I think it was Shirley's, or I'm going to mix this up. Somebody's hero was the mayor, and my book. The premise of it is Paradise Key. There are two of the best friends that live there full time, and Jenna and Lily. And Lily is the one that has passed away. My character, her tía and her tío, before he passed away, worked at the resort. And so every summer, Sophia would come up from Miami and spend the summer with her tía there. And as she got older, she started working at the resort as well. The other two heroines were from ritzier families that would come, and they would vacation and they would stay at the resort all summer. So the resort kind of tied them.
that's how all the girls all
met. Yes, that's how they met. So they met like 11, 12 years old and have just become, you know, and have stayed in contact and become, you know, they're kind of best friends in that way. The genesis of my story was the resort is now run down. The hero's family used to own the resort. And so he's come back into town thinking to rebuy it and build it back up. Sophia's come back into town for Lily's, Lily's funeral. And Sophia manages bed and breakfast, and her dream is to own her own place.
Buy it. So they're butting heads place. Because they both would like to buy the resort.
So for mine is a second chance reunion love story. They dated when they were in high school, you know, in the summers, and kind of have maintained contact. But you know, something happened that kind of tore them apart. And so it's a reunion love story. They're both vying to bid on the resort, and the town council gets to decide who's going to get, you know, who's going to win the bid. But it's
sounds so good.
And a lot of
dang it, more books to add to my list.
Yes,
this is the saddest problem. Yes.
So actually, they came up with the idea. We pitched the idea to Thule, got the yes, and so we all wrote them. And actually, they all came out. They were May. So like Shirley's was May 1st, and then like May 7th or 8th was Kira's. Mine came out like May 17th, and then Susan's came out a week later.
That's smart. So it's just one book each week, and then the whole series was out.
Yes. Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yes. So, and it worked out. It worked out really well. Like I said, we all got along. And for me, it was really, I was really nervous about, because all of the girls.
Yeah, you never know how you're going to work with other people or what their process is. And, you know, is that going to pull your process down? And
yes.
But it kind of sounds like it really worked like a dream.
Mm-hmm. Well,
everyone was very open to each other's
ideas. System. Yeah. Well, because we wanted to, one thing that I liked about it in my books, in my personal books with Kensington, so like in the Match to Perfection series and in the novella that just came out, has a cousin in the Fernandez familia. So all four of the books that I will have out with Kensington, they're all in the same family, like the Fernandez family. And because they're familia, all of the girls show up in each other's books, you know, like in a lot of Latino families and a lot of families in general, your family is in your business, whether you want to or not. Right. And so in that kind of similar vein, I feel like we were able to create Paradise Key. Those girls are familia by choice.
Yeah.
You know, and so we have the girls showing up in each other's books. So we had to work together. If I had a scene that had Shirley's heroine, then I would shoot it to her and say, and Shirley vice versa.
Is this okay?
She sent me a scene. Yes. Kira, because we were all on different deadlines for different publishers, like we were writing our books. Some of us
around
the other stuff. So Kira actually finished first, and she sent us a couple scenes. Hey, here is a scene with all of the girls. And then she wound up sending me her book. So because those first three are concurrent, kind of like around the same 2 or 3 weeks. Mine goes a week longer than Kira's. But I realized right away, oh, my gosh, if Kira says that all of the girls are at Scallywags on Monday night having dinner, I can't say that Sophia is somewhere else, because if a reader
realizes.
So it kind of, I had to make sure that I wrote around her timeline, or when Sophia wasn't in the picture, then that was okay. I had a free for all for what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
But like,
well, it's fun though, because it kind of gives you, you really have to dial in
your,
like everything has to be really on point, which is probably, I mean, I would think that's a really interesting writing exercise in a way.
Yes. Yeah.
You don't just get to freewheel it. Like, well, I think they'll go here. It's like, that doesn't exist in this world. Well, shoot.
Yeah.
Okay, they won't go there.
So I think you could look at it one of two ways. Like, glass half empty. Oh my gosh, I'm stuck. I have to write around
this. That's a lot of extra work. Right. Yeah.
Glass half full. I thought it was challenging, and I hope it adds more. So like my opening scene, when Sophia and Nate run into each other, she's on her way to Scallywags, because if you had read Kira's book the week before, you knew that the girls were at Scallywags. And then when we get the scene in Nate's first, like, in his perspective, he's actually at Scallywags and he's looking across the bar at the table where all the girls are. You know, so that doesn't happen all the time, but, you know, there are.
Well, it's almost like a fun little wink, you know? I mean, it's like in your family series where it's, you know, I mean, you're always, you know, book four of a series with the same heroes and heroines, like you can have a little wink to the first book where it doesn't necessarily interrupt if someone hasn't read the first book, but someone who has read the first book goes, yes. Oh, I know what that reference is to. All these little inside jokes and inside connections.
Yes. So I tried to, like, in my Match for Affection series, Lily, the youngest, who her book will come out in December, in the first two books, she's in college, and she has, Lily's kind of like considered the wild child, you know, that always moving a mile a minute, and she's got a short pixie haircut. Flash forward to her book, and... when I got my cover, Lily has really long hair, and I at first thought was, oh my gosh, that's not it.
No.
But yes. However, so what we wound up doing is it's Lily's out of college. You know, obviously she's been working as victims advocate for several years, so she's grown out her hair, mm-hmm. Like in those years. But yet, I still remembered her as that younger Lily in those first two books. So there is a scene where she's talking with Rosa, and Rosa kind of like tugs her hair and tells her, you know, yeah, even though, you know, you're all grown up, you know, and you've grown your hair out, I still think of you as that little girl running, you know, with the spike hairdo running around at, you know, and then the conversation. So I hope that, you know, those who maybe read book one and two and are now reading book three will, you know, we'll kind of remember what she was like in those first two books and see like the aged, even though it's only like 4 years, but the little bit more mature.
You see that development of her maturity.
I hope so anyway. I don't know. Readers so could be book, like saying, no way.
Yeah. Like, no. Well, I don't know. There's people will be happy or not happy. I mean, in the end, it's almost none of our business.
Yes.
You know, I mean, like I've written this and, you know, hopefully you like it and I've done the best that I can with it. And after that, it's out in the world and there's, now it's yours. So if you're pissed about it, good for you. And if not, yay. I mean, I think that's the way that I've kind of come to view it. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's once it's out in the world, it's really out of my control. It's,
yes. Yes.
Or otherwise you drive yourself insane.
And to me, that's the scary part. I think.
I have to tell you, it does get easier. That part does get easier because you know, I mean, again, it's like you've written a lot of books and you've done this for a long time and you know that you know how to do it on a base level that, mm-hmm. you know, and I think, you know, now you're kind of in the early parts of getting the feedback of that from outside sources, readers.
Yes.
And at some point, I mean, I don't know, that's what I had to do is just to say, you know, they're not wrong because that's just the experience they had when reading the book.
Yeah.
But it has really nothing to do with me because if you try to catch what they want, you're going to chase your tail forever because everybody wants something different.
Yeah. I think, do you read reviews?
I try not to. I mean, you know, I'm indie, so I have a very different setup. You know, I mean, I run when I do a NetGalley and I get, you know, I get to see what people are saying because it sends it to me because I wish I could just say, please don't send it to me. I don't want to know. So I kind of can see like stars and that sort of thing. And, you know, I kind of have to track it a little bit just to know who's actually reviewing and who's not so that when I do my next one. So there's a little bit more, but I try not to as much as possible just because, you know, a good review just swells your head up and a bad review just crushes you. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there's days when I'm just like, oh my God, I'm the worst. So, you know, I just try to stay out of it.
Yeah. I think I know I'm really hard on myself, like, you know, like, is it good enough for me, the pressure becomes because characters come before plot. And so I really try to get to know my characters. So then I really love my characters. So the stress for me really when I'm writing is, am I doing a good enough job for my characters? Like, am I telling their story the best way I can so that readers will fall in love with them like I do? So I don't
know. Yeah, that's what bothers me the most when someone says, oh, I didn't like that character. I'm like, you jerk.
Yeah, yeah.
How can you not like them? Yeah. They're amazing.
Yeah. So I've tried when I have read, I'm trying to think of when was the last time I read my reviews. Frankly, it's because you get busy. Like you have to focus on what you can control and you can't control, you know, like you just said, what someone else is saying. They want to put that review, whether if it's good, yes, thank you. If it's bad. And I've read it. When I've read bad reviews, I've just tried to read them from the perspective of, is there something in here that I can learn from that I can maybe take in the book I'm working on right now to, you know, try to improve? And there have been times I've read them and I'm like, this person just needed to share their thoughts, but I didn't find, you know, something helpful. So move on. Like, I can't take it personally. You know, we
it's
all
hard,
have
though.
Different
thoughts. There's always going to be days though, when it just smacks you in the face.
Oh yeah. Yes.
So, the book we were just talking about, Lily's book, is their perfect melody, right? Is that
yes.
mm-hmm. what it's called? And it's coming out, November 27th, which by the time this airs will be yesterday. So it's out. Yay.
Yay.
And it's doing well. It's doing great. But Publishers Weekly chose that as a best book of 2018.
Yes.
Which is amazing. I mean, so how did you hear that news?
Well, Publishers Weekly shared it with, Kensington. Who let me know, but then I found out that it had been about a week before, so I kind of knew, but I had to, like, keep it on the hush-hush.
Right, because they hadn't actually officially released the list yet.
And then I had gotten the review, they gave it a starred review, and so I think I was going to Publishers Weekly to look for the review. And they also did an interview of me. So I was I was online and I was clicking over to Publishers Weekly to try to grab, the link to share that. And it came up like the best, you know, when I typed in my name and Publishers Weekly into Google, that came. So that's how I found out.
And then you're just staring at it like, what's happening?
I was like, oh my gosh. And I'm in the airport in Austin. And I'm like, did I say that out loud, or was that just in my head? That thank goodness I knew it was like, oh my gosh, not oh, and then expletive, because then I would have been really embarrassed in the Austin airport.
That would have been super embarrassing.
So that's how I knew that it was like live on their site. And so then I just had like a. Like an exciting moment in the middle of the Austin airport, wishing that there was someone there I knew that I could hug.
I know you want to tell somebody, you want to show it to someone, like, yes. Excuse me, stranger, yes, look, yes. That's me.
Yes. So that good news was, I just found out like since this is like later in November, I found out in October. But yeah. Online.
Well, it's so exciting because it's so few books that they pick. I mean, in each genre. So they have, you know, they have best romance, best mystery, best thriller, best. And there's not very many books that they pick. So it's a huge deal, especially with this is your fifth book. So, right? Fifth or sixth? Is it your sixth?
No, it'll be my fourth, right? Yes. So
fourth full-length book, and then you have
the novella. So yeah, five published things. So yes.
That's amazing. And again, I mean, I think it speaks to the experience that you had before you were published really has, you know, made you such a strong writer, you know, to be, I mean, it's like the Sheryl Crow thing. Oh, she was an overnight success, except she did it for 20 years beforehand, but whatever. So, I mean, I'm sure people could be like, oh my God, this is only her fifth book, but it's like, yeah, but I've been doing this for a while.
I hope, I mean, I get that how we talked about it, it's so, you know, everything is subjective. And really, I think what we're all just trying to do is write the best book we can for ourselves and for our characters and for our readers. And when something like this comes up, you know, when an entity, when you get a starred review, when you get picked for this list, it is nice because there is so much other rejection and so much doubt that we deal with. Really, like, I'm excited that they picked it for the book. I'm like excited for Lily. There's that maybe that weird author, you know, how your characters become like real people, you know? Mm-hmm. So like, I'm almost like, oh, I can't wait to tell Lily. Only like she already knows, 'cause she's in my head, you know?
There, I told her.
So I'm super, super thankful. And, but you know, that whole, it takes a village. I have a great editor and you know, family at Kensington, and my agent is amazing, and I have really good support groups as far as the other chicas in there are four of us Latinx ROM authors
I wanted to talk about that. You have a Facebook group called the Four Chicas Chat on Facebook, right? Mm-hmm. And so how did you guys form the group and I don't know.
What, how did we get started?
What do you want to say about it?
Sure. Well, I guess I'll say real quickly, because some people, Latin X, so it's like Latin with the X at the end. Some people, I've gotten a couple people that are like, hey, there's a typo on your site or in your email. I'm like, no, Latin X is a relatively newish term that kind of started on college campuses and within academia. You know, the Spanish language can be like male dominated, male female, with the O or the A, you know, the O or the A at the end. But the X is to be inclusive of all, especially with like gender identification. So right. We have a group. There are four of us that are, we're all Latinx, we're all Latinas. So romance writers, and it's Mia Sosa and Alexis Daria and Sabrina Soul, and then me. And we kind of came together last year when I was getting ready for my debut. I had the idea, my debut was October, which is like the tail end, the last 2 weeks of Hispanic Heritage Month. So I pitched an idea to HEA USA Today of maybe doing an interview with some other Latinas, with some other Latinx romance authors. And so I reached out. I knew all three of the ladies individually. Some of them had never met each other, but I reached out to the three of them to say, hey, if I pitch this idea for like an interview of us, would you guys be interested? And they all said yes. So we did the interview for HEA USA Today. And then out of that, you know, just our conversations, and we all just kind of clicked. And it became, you know, we kind of did a little bit of promo together, and it just kind of grew from there. The list of Latinx romance authors is not as long as we would like it to be. It's growing, thankfully, and kind of the call for more diversity and multiculturalism, but diversity of all kinds within the romance industry, within writing and publishing as a whole, on all sides of the table, whether it's as authors, as the characters in their books, and industry professionals. You know, there's a call to have more diversity all the way around. And so the four of us, we started our Facebook group, it's called Four, like the number four, Chicas Chat, as a space for us and other readers and other authors who want to talk about, yes, we do talk about Latino, you know, stuff, our culture, but we talk about books, we talk about entertainment, we talk about funny stories we've seen. So it's similar to other author reader groups that are out there that are on Facebook. Ours, we also do, you know, talk about things that have to do with our culture, because that's a big part of who we are as individuals. It's part of many of our books. You know, I write with totally thus far. My published books are Latino characters, Latinx characters. Some of the others write with a mix. And so our hope is that we can continue to be part of the conversation, helping to keep it relevant, to help be part of the change, but also to be, you know, growing as individuals, growing as authors. But
have you found any pushback industry-wise about having all of your characters be Latino or Latina characters?
Do
you find that acceptance in the industry? Has anyone sort of tried to?
No, I will say early on, I feel like my first two books that I wrote that are not even under the bed because they're in a floppy disk somewhere did not have Latino characters. And I feel like I was doing what I recommend to my students and what I still do, studying the other books to kind of learn about the craft, learn how authors, but I was also mimicking, I think without even realizing it, because I didn't see a lot. I was writing characters like what I was seeing on the shelf. And when, as I matured and became more confident with my writing, and then also I think maybe then trusted my instincts more, and I started telling the stories more that were like in me and the world around me is when I made that move to writing. They're not always Latinx characters. Yes, all of my sisters are, and you know, in my Fernandez Familia Match to Perfection with Kensington. Yes, Sophia is in the Paradise Key series, but like Rosa's hero, Jeremy, is not Latino. And in the anthology, in the novela, Ben is not Latino, because that's not how he came to me. So
right.
Mostly for me, I think it's me personally listening to the characters that have come to me. And my world is diverse. I have, friends. And so those are the characters that come to me. There was a time, yes, when someone did say, well, you want to be, maybe you don't want to limit yourself. And to that, I just say, I don't see it as limiting. I see it as being true to what's in my heart and what I want to write. And
well,
that's
the world isn't all white. And so the idea that somehow that would limit, that doesn't make sense to me.
No. So,
well, I mean, it does seem like it's a good time, you know, to be sort of coming in as there is more of a push for diversity and for representation, because I mean, what you're saying is that books you were reading back when you started, they didn't have anyone who looked like you or had an experience like you. And I mean, you're creating something that I can enjoy as a Caucasian woman because it's just a great story, but somebody else is going to say, that's me. That's me. And that's so powerful, and everyone should have that experience.
Oh, it is. I was just at the Austin, I was in Austin for the Texas Book Festival this past weekend. And after the panel, we had a signing, and I had a reader come up to me, a young girl, and she was buying book two. She said she had read book one. She had read Yasmin's, His Perfect Partner. She was buying Rosa's story, Her Perfect Affair. And she said she and a friend had started a blog, and they reviewed some books, and she was super excited to get book two and review it. And she was Latina, so we were kind of a mix of, you know, we had a good thing of Spanglish going on back and forth. But while I was signing, she leaned across the table in Spanish, and she said, I just wanted to thank you for writing your stories, because it's not often, it's rarely that I get to see someone like me. And it just means a lot. And so I wanted to say thank you. I know other authors, hear the same thing. I think it's important for anybody, to be able to identify. Yes, I have had people who are non-Latino ask me if I'm not, Latinx, if I'm not Hispanic, whatever verbiage they want to use, am I going to get your books? And my response to them is, yes, Lily and Rosa and Yasmin and Sophia and Julia are Latina, but that's not all they are. That's an aspect. And
a
romance,
part of who
a romance is we all love the same way, and we hurt in similar ways, and we want similar things and different things. Yes. But at the heart of all of our romance novels is a healthy relationship and learning how to build a healthy relationship and overcome conflicts. Because we all, no matter where we come from or our lifestyle choice, or how we identify, any of those things, ultimately we're seeking happiness. And part of that happiness, if you're looking at love relationships, it's with another partner.
Right. Finding a person that's your person.
Yes. Yes.
And that's across the board experience.
Yes.
Everyone wants to be loved and accepted.
Yes.
And that's gotta be the most powerful thing that you can hear, is that, because it's the most powerful thing anybody can hear. I mean, if someone comes to me and says, what you wrote meant something to me, what you wrote made me think about my own situation, that's important.
Yes.
That's the most important thing we can do.
Yes.
And I mean, that more and more people get to see themselves in books, I think that's never going to be a negative.
I completely agree. And I think how you mentioned about like the world that we live in is diverse. I see that in, on Facebook, I'm with, the Four Chicas were really strong. I'm also blessed to be part of, there's another group, we're called, our Facebook group is called Fiction from the Heart. And there are 11 or 12 of us in that group. But it's, you know, they're varying backgrounds and varying, you know, lengths of from, you know, Barbara O'Neill, who's had like 63, you know, books come out, and Donna Kaufman, to me, who, when we first started, I was like, okay, my first book is coming out next month. but it's a beautiful space in, you know, on the space itself, you know, in Fiction from the Heart, the conversations that we have with a wide variety of readers, to even our private thread, the, mm-hmm. you know, the advice we have. So, you know, like I was saying before, I do feel really blessed to, being a member of RWA and Seton Hill and the content. It's, yes, it took me a long time to get here, but I've had a lot of people who are blessings in my life that have been super supportive, you know, my personal life with my familia, but my writing familia, my writing community, you know, as well. I think that's what I love about romance writing in general is maybe, and I hear it's different in different genres. I cannot speak to those, but I can tell you that within romance, predominantly, or for the most part, you know, everybody's really supportive of each other. There is, there's enough pie to go around.
Yeah. You know, like the pie never runs out. Yes. Someone else getting a piece of pie doesn't mean there's no pie. There's more pie coming from the kitchen constantly.
Yes.
And I think we do as a genre, at least attempt to get that. And, you know, hopefully we'll see more and more positive changes in the next few years.
I agree. That's the goal of a lot of people. And that's a beautiful thing.
Well, we're out of time.
Oh, goodness.
Shockingly, our hour has just flown by. Do you want to tell everyone about, well, at this point, your book that just came out is Their Perfect Melody. So do you want to tell everyone a little bit about that? I mean, we've been talking about it. It sounds amazing.
Sure.
and also, like, they can get it everywhere, right?
Yes.
It's wide.
Mm-hmm. All of my Kensington books are print, digital, and audio. And the Thule book, it's Resort to Love, is print and digital. As of now, so with the book that's it releases November 27th, but it's technically like on paper a December.
Yeah, it's a December
release.
Book. It's the weirdness of publishing.
I know. Yeah, it took me the first time. I was like, wait a minute, I think I got something wrong here.
That always threw me off when I wrote for Avon.
Yeah,
I was like, no, it isn't.
It's a little
okay.
So it's book three in my Match to Perfection series. The title is Their Perfect Melody. And this is Lili's story. Lili's the baby of the Fernandez sister triumvirate, or, you know, trio. Lili is a victim's advocate. She's working in Chicago, in the Humboldt Park area, heavy Latino area. And her hero is Diego. Diego Reyes is Chicago PD, and for the rose-colored glasses that Lili has on, Diego is street smart and cut and dry, and there's a right way and a wrong way, and so it's kind of a story of opposites attract. They're two people who both have the same desire and drive to make a difference in their community. They just kind of go about it a little different,
angles,
a different way. Diego, I will say there is a musical thread through most of the books. In book one, you meet Papi, the girl's dad, and he plays in a trio, so like a trio group. And his trio, they play a lot of the old Spanish love songs, a lot of romances that I remember my parents listening to, and so I listened to, and so Papi's music is a lot in book one, and some in Rosa's. In book three, Diego plays the classical Spanish guitar, and Lili, you know, has sung in the past with Papi, and so music plays a big part of their romance, or of how their connection. And I don't want to give anything away, but there is a connection. Papi is in that book because Lili and Diego realize, or they discover that they have, he has a connection to both of them, obviously to Lili as her father, but there is a connection with Diego that I didn't know was going to happen, but it just came to
me. That's always fun when you find something.
Yes.
And if I haven't read book one or book two, can I come into book three and I won't be lost? Or is it something that you thing. Okay. Yeah. So no. Like it can be read as a standalone.
Yeah, they're all standalone. They're all standalone. So yeah, you don't need my hope is I do a good enough job and Yasmin and Rosa and actually Julia, the heroine in the anthology, they are all in scenes with Lily, you know, family events that they're at together. And so my hope is that you meet the other three ladies and want to go find their love stories as well. But yeah, you can read them all standalone.
Awesome.
Yes.
Well, thanks again for doing this and congratulations again on the best of 2018. That's really, really cool.
Thank you so much. I had a great time chatting and I look forward to hopefully like seeing you again down the road, maybe at an RWA event or something like that.
Yeah, okay. Totally. We'll have to find each other and continue this conversation in person.
Sounds good.
This has been Journeys of Romance. I'm Jess Michaels, your host. Thanks for joining us and we'll see you again next time.